Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman, where every week I take a dive into a conversation to celebrate the beautiful relationship between the moving image and music. Sometimes we have directors, sometimes we have writers, we have producers, we have actors, and like last week, we had a music supervisor. Thanks so much for all your lovely comments about Maggie Phillips' conversation and her dog. It's really nice to shine a light on those wonderful creatives that are such an important part of the journey to what we experience when we watch it on the big or the small screen. And Maggie has worked across both kind of extensively, so it was really great to dive into a conversation with her. If you haven't listened to that yet, then please do go and check it out. But our latest guest on Soundtracking, I'm so excited to share this with you, is the wonderful actor Andrew Scott. Come on, we all adore Andrew. He joined me in front of a live audience as part of our Everyman Soundtrack and Film Club to discuss the critically lauded Netflix series Ripley. The show is shot in black and white. It's dark, it's brooding, beautiful retelling of Patricia Highsmith's classic novel, The Talented Mr. Ripley, in which Andrew delivers a performance as the titular anti-hero described by the Guardian's newspaper as absolutely spellbinding. And I have to agree. If I was to describe the show to you, it's very different from the film, obviously, and shouldn't really be compared because they're two completely, even though they're the same character, completely different interpretations of that story and this character. For me, the show has got the most beautiful, considered pace to it. If you were to place yourself in one of the world's most beautiful art galleries with the most fascinating and intriguing pieces of art, and you were there alone, and you were given as much time as you wanted to devour the art that is around that building, and you were taken in the building and as well, and you could hear those footsteps as you made your way through that building. That's what this show is like. It's got this fantastic pace that not only allows you to really savour aesthetically how beautiful it's been shot, but also just to, I don't know, it kind of really heightens the drama and the tension in the show as well. I loved it. Ripley is scored by Jeff Russo and we'll begin with his cue, Dickie by Day. Andrew Scott, everybody! Yeah!
Okay. Sorry, that took a while.
No, it's worth waiting for.
I didn't realise.
We're just warming them up for the right level of cheer for you. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks. So what, you watched 1 to 3?
3, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You just done, finished on the boat?
Yeah. Dark as hell.
Yeah.
Right. It's so cinematic though, Andrew. It warranted being seen on the big screen. So
yeah,
it's been
it does. It's Robert Elswit who is the DP for a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson movies and lots of other incredible movies. He's a complete genius.
Is it different shooting in black and white?
Not really. We didn't know whether we'd be allowed have it in black and white at the time. It was with Showtime, and Steve Zalian always wanted to shoot it in black and white, but they didn't know whether television audiences would accept that or whether executives would accept it. So they had a sort of contingency plan. So there were 2 monitors always on set, one in black and white and one in a kind of more muted color. It was never going to be like, you know, saturated in color, but they always hoped that it would be in black and white, but not necessarily.
Yeah, you can't imagine it being anything else.
Now you can't see it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, the worry is people do get put off by black and white a little, because there's never been. Yeah, people do, not people here.
Clearly not. Not the response
not the
that
classy
got when it
finished. Bunch here. I think some people do, and that's, you know, just something you're just going to have to sacrifice, because he had a really, really strong vision that it was going to be black and white, and he saw it really, he wanted it to be a real film noir. And also, you know, there's been so many famous iterations of the story, you know, with the Anthony Minghella film and the Alain Delon one, and so he just saw it in this very particular way.
It feels like the kind of time that we need to give this character, because he's such a fascinating individual. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when we watch this, we spend so much time with you, with him.
Yeah.
I don't roll your eyes. It's a really lovely thing for us.
No, I spend a lot of time with myself too. So
but we spend,
I know what it's like.
So much time, but so much that time he spends alone as well. Mm. These great scenes that you have with Elm, with Johnny and stuff are fantastic. But when you're on your own as well, we're still being told so much of the story through...
Yeah, through him.
Yeah.
I think what's kind of quietly sort of revolutionary about this as a limited series is that we watch television in a completely different way than we used to. And the pacing of it is so specific and kind of unusual and arresting for people. And I think it sort of teaches the audience to watch television the way you might read a novel, which is what the intention of having an 8-hour version of it, because you don't really binge a novel a lot of the time. You know, you don't sit down and go, I've got to get this. Oh, let's just read another chapter. You do a little bit, but you might do 4 chapters or you might do 2. It'd be kind of unusual to sit down and read a whole book, although, of course, we do that sometimes. So this idea that you can sort of sit down and spend a real quality amount of time with one character is quite unusual, because if you think in the first person in a book, you can spend as much time as you like with a character, and you hear the machinations of his mind. And my question was like, how do you represent that sort of cinematically, you know? How do you, and the only thing you can really do is to spend as much time as possible with them and not apologize. And I love in a novel when you kind of go off center, there can be something that, like a description of something for over 6 pages, and you just sort of turn left into a little maze, and then you come out of it again. And that's what the attempt is here. But yeah, it was very unusual to spend so much time as an actor on your own. You know, you really do. In a movie, I've done it a lot in a movie, which takes maybe 2 months. Mm-hmm. But this we shot over a year.
It's a long time
on your own. And of course, it was bits with Dakota and bits with Johnny and bits with everybody else. But I did find that hard, and I think it is unusual.
I got the wrong fanning sister. I said L, didn't I?
Did you say?
Jesus, got my fannings messed up.
You got you fucked up your fannings. Sorry.
I got to get that on a t-shirt.
Don't fuck with the fannings. It took a year.
Ooh,
yeah. Well, like usually, if you think about a TV series, they're usually about at least a couple or a family or a police department or a hospital or something. There's usually a group of people. Mm-hmm. So that it's not usually about sort of one person. So that kind of relentless amount of time is quite unusual in a TV series, because I was desperately trying to think of another actor who would have acted as much as I was about to act.
Yeah.
I knew going into it, I was like, just being on a film set every day for 12, 13 hours, every day for a year, it's too much acting, actually.
We got to the end of it.
I did.
But you got to the end of it was like 2 weeks, and then you were straight into All of Our Strangers or something.
It was delayed for loads of reasons. The Ripley shoot, it was kind of towards the end of the pandemic, and I was due to start All of Our Strangers, and I just didn't want to give up that job. And actually, it was quite a good thing because I was back in London and it was a completely different vibe. I was getting the Jubilee line up to Wembley where we shot that. Yeah. And we're shooting in Croydon. You know, it's different, very different to this. In a completely different way, but it was cool. It was cool.
One extreme of the other.
Yeah. So it was really, it was actually, you know, it was great. It was great, yeah.
We'll talk about that in a second, but quickly, I wanted to talk about music in Ripley because music's kind of ever-present within the show that we watch, and I wasn't sure how much you were kind of privy to that whilst shooting, or whether Steve kind of gave you an insight into elements of it. I mean, there's some brilliant kind of recurring songs like Quando, Quando, Quando that kind of comes up in different episodes, repeats and stuff, so cleverly
used.
Yeah,
it's beautiful.
Dimmi quando tu verrai. Dimmi quando, 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 l'anno, il giorno e l'ora in cui, forse tu mi bacerai, ogni istante attenderà, fino a quando, 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 d'improvviso ti vedrò. Sorridente accanto a me, se vuoi dirmi di sì, devi dirlo perché non ha senso per me la mia vita senza te.
Actually, the thing that I think is quite singular about this is that it's not overscored. I quite like that. I quite like in that scene on the boat, particularly, and there's some scenes later. I don't know if many people have seen the rest of it, but I won't spoil it. It doesn't get lighter. actually, I think it's quite noticeably quiet. It's kind of like sometimes the absence of score and the subtlety of a score, like the creaking of the boat, and just things that perhaps we aren't aware of as an audience, but that he's really incredibly detail oriented.
You can tell it's really, he's got a real attention to the senses of things, because it's even like the footsteps across cobbles or the waves. Absolutely. On the canal really like it's cranked up in the mix, it's to kind of really, it's the atmosphere that it creates
it's exactly
as well.
The atmosphere. He was really obsessed, and we had a lot of conversations about what it would be like to be Tom Ripley rather than to imagine what it's like to be a victim of Tom Ripley. And that's what her great achievement, Patricia Highsmith, who's considered one of the greatest crime writers of all time, is that she makes you root for him, even though he's doing these terrible, terrible things. And that's what the challenge of it is, that you feel, oh God, you know, and as the story progresses, you're kind of hoping that he gets away with it, even though you actually, he's a very hard character, I found, to access in a way, because he's kind of unknowable. But, you know, those people deserve, people who are unknowable and uncomfortable, mm-hmm. I think they can make very fascinating screen characters. And, you know, those kind of people exist in the world, and they're worth representing too. I think sometimes they can be really fascinating people, because the idea that he's our hero, but he's an unreliable hero, I think is a really interesting one.
Did you do much prep for this? What was, apart from learning Italian brilliantly?
Oh, stop it. I spent about 3 or 4 months learning Italian, and that was intimidating. I'm not a great one for it. Sounds like I always find this a difficult one, because I don't want people to think that I am, you know, lazy. But
I just have the ability to rock up, Andrew.
Yeah, just rock up. I'm always on time, and I'm really obsessed about the script. The script is the real Bible. But I don't tend to find. Sometimes I find it just as interesting to know nearly as much as the audience knows. And so that the thing that's the most important is that you're present on the day and you're reacting to what's actually happening, rather than carrying a huge amount of baggage with you. So I absolutely, my prep, I suppose, is to know the script really, really well. I know the script, and I always know the script backwards from beginning to end. And we were very lucky in this one, because if you're doing a TV series, you might get the first couple of episodes and then you go, you're halfway shooting it. I know it hasn't happened to me, but I know with a lot of friends of mine that they go into something and they're given the first two episodes and they think this is sort of great high standard stuff. And then the quality goes down and you think this is completely preposterous. And you're like, I never would have done that in episode one. Helen, and this is going to happen. You know what I mean? Whereas this, we had all eight episodes. I knew it was going to happen. And so you have to mark it out how, particularly in a character like this, because he starts to embody Mr. Green, Dickie Greenleaf. So there's no point in making the journey in any story to go from A to F. You want to go from A to Z. So you want to start as far away from Z as possible, I think. So, you know, so that with that, you have to have the map. You know, you have to sort of go, okay, well, I'm not going to play any of that so that you can bring it out later on. You know what I mean?
Did you have that with Sherlock?
Yeah. Interesting, because Sherlock in some ways is very different because he's the antagonist and this is the protagonist. And so people have asked me, you know, they're both kind of villainous characters. And I wouldn't call Tom really Ripley a villain because he's the protagonist and he's a hero and he's an anti-hero. I definitely concede that he's an anti-hero. But your job, just when there's just frankly just so much of your face, you have to, it can't all just be one note. And sometimes it's easier when you pop up and you're Moriarty and you've got these fantastic scenes. And actually my interest in that, when I was on that show, was to be in it less. You don't want the most powerful character to, you want to get some, you know, want to get good bang for your buck. So you don't want to be in the background. You always want to have an incredible entrance or less lines or everything you say to be sort of as powerful and as iconic as possible. So it's a completely different, it's just different. It's playing a completely different note in the orchestra. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I love as well in this, if you haven't seen the next episode of Ripley, there's a brilliant use of Sinead O'Connor's Silent Night in it, which is just absolutely.
Yeah. God bless Sinead,
absolutely amazing use of that. And that's what's really clever, I think, about the music in it it's not stamped with a time.
No, yeah.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm we see, all is bright.
To Steve's big that's what he wants as man.
I like that because you don't think that looking at it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's kind of, that's absolutely. So clever.
Yeah.
Everything goes on at the screen.
Yeah. And everything, absolutely. And he, you know, you have all this, of course, because we didn't shoot it in black, you know, I wasn't looking at these incredible vistas in Italy in black and white. It was like, wow. And so to be able to have those huge amount of ingredients and to go, I'm not actually choosing to use that incredibly beautiful sky. It's audacious. It's certainly visionary, whether people go for that or not. It's definitely visionary. And I think we need a bit more of that on television, you know, whether people, because it's obviously it divides people and you have to take the risk that people go, oh, well, I would have liked it this way. And, you know, or black and white might put some people off. So God bless the people who, you know, support that kind of work, because that's how you make, you know, very singular work.
What was your first day on All of Us Strangers? What did you shoot?
The first day was, let me just think of the first day, because it's always so nerve-wracking. It's probably put it out of my head. Oh, the first day was with Jamie. So I did all the stuff in the house with Jamie Bell and Claire Foy. We did all that stuff for maybe 2.5 weeks. So it was like a little mini childhood. And then I went and did all the stuff with Paul. So we shot it all in that little in the little house in Croydon. And then I had to say goodbye to him. And it was so sad because we just bonded so much because the stuff is so...
Yeah.
So affecting. And that was my first day. And we all knew actually kind of immediately that it was.
Yeah.
Because you don't know, for those of you who don't know All of Us Strangers, it's about a man who sort of re-meets his parents 30 years after they've died. And so Claire Foy and Jamie Bell, who are younger than me, played my parents. And we didn't do anything to sort of add like a weird ghostly glow to them or anything. It was just like, hello, mum. And we didn't know if that would just be stupid or not. It just didn't. It just immediately worked.
In Andrew's old house.
Yes. So we shot in Andrew Hagar, director's former childhood home, and I just kept saying to him, "Is this not fucking weird?" It's like a tiny little suburban house, you know, like a really small.
I just like that conversation of kind of goes up the door going, "Hi, excuse
hello.
Me.
That's
but
literally
I...
what he did. That's
but
literally
yeah,
what he did.
Like, is it?
Yeah, he knocked on the door and he was like, "Hello, I used to live here.
Can we film?
Can we?" And he was delighted because he was worried that they put in some horrible conservatory or something that didn't make it look like the 80s, you know what I mean? And they hadn't, they'd left it pretty much the way it was. But
wow.
Like tiny, which, and you know, usually when you're filming, you might do something like that in a studio space. So the cameras have a huge amount of space to move. You know, it was very intimate. Such an incredible experience. I'm so proud of both the process and the product of that thing, because that film has really, really affected people across the world. Really, those films are really important.
It felt like a really special film when I saw it the first time,
yeah.
And one that I've gone back to, and one that's really, I think I said to you last time that I spoke to you, that I found myself having dreams. I went back and I spent time with my granddad. I don't know, I think that it'll have that beautiful companionship for so many people for years to come.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think it's just a very simple idea. What would you say, how would you speak to your parents if they were the same age, you know, you are now, or more or less the same age, you know, because we never see our parents like that.
Mm.
And it's beautiful. And I like the fact that it crosses, you know, it's a film that, you know, there's a gay romance at the center of it, but that's not its only attribute, that so many people can relate to it. And I like that. I feel that feels progressive in relation to how we, you know, in our storytelling.
I heard you do, I watched that brilliant Actors and Actors that you did with Greta Lee. And one of the things I loved about that conversation was the way that she spoke to you about how the film depicted falling in love. And I feel like that there's so many things about that film that I love. And that is another element to it, is in terms of, like, falling in love is not the kind of perfect,
oh,
in the way
God,
that it's depicted
no.
on screen most of the time,
yeah.
is that it's this
yeah,
kind
it
of like
sick.
Instagram filter.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, but this was kind of really real. Mm, and there was just something just absolutely gorgeous about that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Feel very proud of that. And it's just a beautiful thing to get to play, you know, and with somebody as wonderful as Paul. And it's just every part of that worked. It really did. So I'm very proud of it.
Because there's brilliant scenes in the film, both, you know, in the club, but also when you're in the flat playing music, watching old Top of the Pops and all that kind of stuff. And sometimes you find that thing, I think, now where our pieces of music are within film or TV and they almost take ownership of them. So that every time you hear them now, you think of that. And so with the Frankie Goes to Hollywood,
oh,
Power,
yeah,
of Love,
yeah, the Power of Love,
all I think about now is that.
Yeah.
And it's beautiful because it just reminds me of the film.
Yeah,
but was music being played?
Yes. Well, the Pet Shop Boys were a big part because we sing it in the movie.
Mm.
And the Power of Love, which is something that Andrew Haig, the director, just wanted at the very, he had this image, that this extraordinarily beautiful song. And he had this idea that, you know, the film was quite indie and quite gritty, but he had this idea that he had this image of these two lovers at the very end, and he wanted this famous kind of gay love song to play. And he wanted these two boys to sort of go up into the stars, and for their love story to be as epic and as take its place amongst the stars as alongside all the other types of love stories, along with this huge swelling beautiful song. So it was very, really courageous. That it always moves me that that's what he wanted and didn't want to move in it. And that's why we need those great artists, you know, to say I have this image, and I'm going to be ferocious in going after it, you know.
I'll protect you from the hooded claw. Keep the vampires from your door. Feels like fire. I'm so in love with you. Dreams are like angels, they keep bad at bay. Love is the light scaring
darkness away, yeah. I'm so in love with you, purge the soul. Make love your goal. The power of love, a force from above, cleaning my soul.
And the way it combined with Emily's beautiful score as well that crafted for that is just...
Again, score is so important. We saw an early screening of it, Paul and I. They showed it, and there was a different score to it, slightly. Yeah. And it really the difference is how music gently guides you or brings you in, or it's such a tool. It really is.
Are you musical? Do you play anything?
No, I don't play any instruments, no.
I heard you say, though, because it was lovely, I was watching you talk about being a kid, and I remember this, like, on the Saturday afternoon, you'd watch, like, there'd always be that old movie that would be on
the
telly.
Oh, yeah, the MGM movies, yeah.
And that kind of, the musicals, whether it was, like, the swimming, synchronized swimming.
It's absolutely, huge spectacles, yeah.
Just the best.
Incredible. They should do more. We should do more of those things,
You want to be in a musical?
I do. I sure do. I need to shut up about that. I sound so desperate.
No, you don't. You really don't.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about that. I was like, oh. And then I remember that Tom Holland's supposedly been in a film about Fred Astaire.
Yeah.
And I was like, Andrew could be Gene Kelly. Oh my God, that would be amazing.
That would be something special.
How's your tap dancing?
I'll learn. I'll do whatever you want me to do. But yeah, that's the thing. All that stuff, I feel like I always wanted to do is just lots of different genres. That to me seems to be like the fun of being an actor, to do lots of different, completely different things. So my musical is not... I sang a tiny bit in the last play in Vanya, the last play that I was in, and I kind of loved it.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it. So, but it was a little. It was only small. It was a little small man singing.
But you want to do big man singing?
Yeah, I want to give it a go. Everyone's going to be bitterly disappointed. But like, I don't necessarily think great musical acting has to be like about having full voice necessarily.
No.
You just have to be able to interpret the song and have a bit of musicality. So he's me making excuses about myself already.
But talking about different genres and stuff, a film that I loved that you were in was Catherine Colbardi.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, yeah.
I love that film so much. Lena Dunham.
Yeah. If anyone hasn't seen it, it's a really
beautiful. It's so great.
Yeah, it's really, she's a magical person. You know,
I just saw a new film that she's just done that she's in with Stephen Fry.
Yes, yeah,
oh,
yeah,
God,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah, she was very funny about that. Lena is a completely magical person. I think people don't really, well, maybe they do, I don't know. But her sets are just fantastic places to be. And what you want as an actor is you want somebody to be completely enabling so that there's a lot of improvisation that she encourages, even though she's a really extraordinary kind of wordsmith. She just encourages you, so you feel like you're playing the whole time.
I love you and Bella together. That's just so great. You and Bella Ramsey.
Yeah, yeah. Bella's just a force of nature. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. And Girls, you know, by Lena Dunham is just this is extraordinary.
It's one of those things that I was reminded about it a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, I'd actually really like to go back and watch it through.
Yeah.
From the start.
Yeah, I think people are doing that now, having a rewatch.
I think it's that thing of kind of like at the time you were just kind of so in it that kind of going back and almost having lived a bit more of a life as well.
Exactly.
To go back
it
and
captures
kind of
a certain something though, that's just completely authentic. And all the people that I really love, the collaborators that I really love are people who are real wordsmiths, you know, like really, really understand the power of language. And that's kind of, it's something I've said before, but I don't think you can make a really great movie out of a mediocre script. I think the script has to have some real strong kind of autograph on it.
Does that work the same with you with music then? Because I think when it comes to music, you're a melody person or you're a lyrics person. Are you a lyrics person?
I think
then?
I'm a lyrics person, yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I definitely do.
I want to ask as well about theatre, because theatre is such, you mentioned Vanya, it's such a important part of your journey.
Yeah.
And it feels really important to you for it to be almost on the horizon of it, always to be something there that you're getting back to that stage, to that opportunity.
Yeah.
What does it feed you? What does it give you? What do you love about theatre?
There's no doubt. Like when you make a film,
You might shoot...
On a good day, you might shoot maybe 6 or 7 minutes a day. You know, you don't, you know, because you have to cover everybody. You know, you have to do your close-up, my close-up. If we were filming this scene, we'd have to set this up. We'd have to do a wide shot. It takes a long time. And there's a lot of repetition. So your imagination, naturally, is going to be constantly interrupted. You're not shooting in sequence. You're shooting scene 67 because we can get the location first for, you know. Whereas when you go into the theater, you start right at the very beginning. Everybody's completely focused. The lights are down. And so you are the chief storyteller. And so there's something about that thrill and the childlike, just very primitive way of storytelling that I find enthralling. And I also love the fact that I don't have to ever see it. Because I hate...
Do you?
Oh, my God, I can't stand it. I can't stand it. And I'm getting worse. Like, I would never be able to watch. I saw this old shit before. No. I can sort of recognize, I think.
You can't detach.
Not fully. No, I find it very hard in Ripley because there was no escaping. If I could watch for example, Catherine called Birdie, and you're playing a supporting character and Bella's in it, like, oh God, that scene is completely wonderful. So you have a break from looking at your face. Yeah. Well, you know, most of us don't like looking at our, you know, when you see a photograph of yourself, you think, oh God, I don't look like that. And people are like, that's gorgeous of you.
Oh, yeah.
And you think, oh, don't God, ask me to like,
to look, when you get like contact sheets still and you're like, which one? Oh, fuck off.
Absolutely horrific.
Awful.
That's the thing that you have to do in movies. They send you, and it's usually one of the first things you see. You haven't seen the film yet. And they send you a contact sheet of the stills photography. And you think, oh God, this is going to be dreadful. I just had it the other day. And you have to choose, you know, the best of a bad lot. I always say that it's like when you hear your voice on someone else's answering machine, you think, please tell me I don't sound like that.
We used to have Snoop sessions on the radio, where when you started doing a radio show, you would do Snoop sessions with the boss, which would be the show with all the music taken out, just you talking, and they'd play it and then they'd stop after every link and they'd go, so then.
Oh, right.
And you'd like critique every link that you did. By the end of it, you were like sobbing on the floor. I'm never working again.
They say to you, they say that was a bit, that sounded a bit slow. You need to pick up the pace.
Bit Scottish. Don't be. Right.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. A bit regional. Pain. That's what I get to.
Do you?
Well, because they used to sort of rather love all the sort of, you know, terribly, terribly posh.
Yeah.
And now, you know,
surprised I've got a job, to be honest.
Exactly. They don't mind us now. They've let us in.
Oh, yeah. Regional sexy. Maybe not.
It is.
That's such a funny part of the world, though, of having to kind of remove yourself as well.
It's very strange.
Yeah.
It's so weird. And sometimes when you have to go in and do post-syncing, which is where you have to match, because there might have been a lawnmower or something in the background. I don't know why a lawnmower in Italy, but like, you know what I mean? A boat. Let's call it a boat.
Quaffed lawns.
Yeah. And so you have to go and you have to re-record your dialogue in what they call an ADR session or a post-syncing session. And it's always horrific. Now, you haven't seen the film. And they're like, first of all, they're at pains to tell you that it's not because your performance is dreadful. It's because there's a technical error. But you always think it is because of you. They just want you to. And then you go in and the first thing you see is a screen grab
of your face.
It's like a huge, and you think, oh, fucking hell. And then they make you re-record something that is, you know, if we were to re-record what we've just said, the idiosyncratic way that people speak. And then the worst thing that you have to, that you ever have to do is if you've done a sex scene.
Oh, God.
Which is, you know, embarrassing enough. But to do a sex scene just matching, just when you're sitting in your clothes in November, you know, 7 months later.
With 12 people in a booth watching you.
12 people in a booth. And someone's coming, any snacks? And you're like, no, thanks. Let's just get this over with. It's actually much worse. It's actually much
getting
worse.
Getting notes on that as well.
Getting notes, yeah, exactly. Pick up the pace.
You're a bit sweatier.
exactly. That is literally the kind of, that's the kind of stuff you get. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. The more I think about it, the more I think, what a fucking weird thing to do for a living. Being an actor. Like, sometimes it still hits me sometimes. You think, this is so weird. What am I doing? I mean, it's great, but it's It's an odd way to spend your life.
Never a dull moment.
Exactly.
If I was to, I'm not going to sing it to you, but if I was to sing Dido's White Flag, uh-huh. what does it make you think of?
That makes me think immediately of the fox in Fleabag.
I love this story. And
the reason it does is that we shot the final scene of Fleabag, which takes place in a bus stop in the middle of London. So we were on a night shoot, and so it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was this fox that was employed, like a professional.
I bet he doesn't have to do ADR sex noises.
No, probably doesn't, exactly. Oh, I don't like foxes. Sex noises are sinister enough.
Yeah.
We don't need to repeat on that. But whatever you're having yourself. but anyway, we were waiting for this fox, and the fox, you know, it's a trained fox because it has to do a particular thing. It can't just like get any random foxes you see, you know, just wait around waiting for one. So we were waiting with this fox, and then the fox's agent or handler or whatever it is says the fox is very sensitive, and the fox was in this kind of fox trailer, like a carrier thing.
Yeah, cage.
But it was very sensitive, and the way this fox had been trained was that it would only emerge from the cage if it heard "I Won't Go Down With This Ship" by Dido, whatever the White Flag. Isn't that I don't know where that started. I won't go down. So we all had to be really sensitive, and we were literally behind. They're like, "Don't look at him! Don't look at him! Don't look at him!" Oh, so we were sort of behind this thing. And they'd press play. This is 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of like Shepherd's Bush or somewhere. I won't put my hand up. And then... And the fox then came out. And then the fox did not actually behave very well, so they didn't end up even using the fucking fox.
That's amazing.
Isn't that extraordinary? Oh, poor Al Dido.
Dido, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
She didn't deserve that.
He
did go down with that ship.
I know you think that I shouldn't still love you. I'll tell you that. But if I didn't say it, well, I'd still have felt it. Where's the sense in that? I'm not trying to make your life harder. I'll return to where we were. But I will go down with this ship, and I won't put my hands up and surrender. There will be no white flag above my door. I'm in love, and
a name? Did you give him a name?
Yeah, I won't repeat it.
Okay. Not the fox, the priest.
Oh, the priest. Oh, sorry. I thought you meant the fox.
Fox, yeah. Either, yeah.
Michael J. I didn't. Didn't give the priest a name. What I always find really extraordinary, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about backstory or prep or biography mm-hmm. or all those things. Actually, what you need to make really great drama is not very much. You know, we don't know Fleabag's name, or Olivia Colman's character is called Godmother. And so this sort of beautiful love story between these two people, we don't know either of their names.
Yeah.
It can still exist. It's amazing what, you know, the most important thing, I always think this when you're making something, is that there's aliveness between the two people. No matter, you know, even when we're in a restaurant and you see two people, you know, having an argument about something, it allows the observer to create their own story mm-hmm. a little. So sometimes having all that kind of stuff, you know, for some actors, it's incredibly useful. But for me, it isn't, because then it means that you're just prioritizing the aliveness. And what Phoebe is incredible at is creating that atmosphere on set. And Lena, actually, as well. Just that thing where you go, well, we're here now. And the most important thing, because sets can be very intimidating places, and where the concern can be about so many different things, the lighting, the, you know, whether there's traffic having to be stopped at a particular time. So many different departments are at work, and you know, the the chief priority can sometimes be, we have to complete the call sheet. We have to get, we've got to get this done before the light goes or whatever. So you have to be able to have somebody who is going, yeah, but we have to capture this magic, because if we don't have between action and cut, if we don't have this sort of chemistry between people, then we don't have anything. And that's what the audience wants to see. So you have to be, you have to forget about everything. You have to do, film acting seems to me so much about blocking out so much stuff so that you can imaginatively go somewhere that could be so far where you're from. If you're doing a period drama, or if you're in a completely different emotional state, you know, than the set is. So, you know, if we're doing that All of Us Strangers scene at the end where the parents are dying, you're shooting that in the middle of a shopping center, and it's a chirpy crew. It was in the middle of the summer. Everybody's happy. And so you have to be able to go, my job, I'm not saying that you have to be like, everybody be quiet all the time, but I can understand why people sometimes say we have to be thinking about the audience, and that has to take priority. And sometimes a director might have to say, look, everybody calm down on the set, even though of course everybody wants it to be convivial, but our job, our first priority is to serve the, is to serve the people beyond this. The bigger picture is that.
The way you say thank you to the waitress when she comes across to the table.
Oh, yeah.
Saying so much in one word.
Yeah. Well, those cinematic moments are, they're, sometimes they're just the simplest ones, aren't they? Yeah.
I've got you a present.
Oh, my God. I didn't get you anything.
It's a silly present. You can open it now, please, because it's got a purpose.
It does? This is
exciting. I hope you'll actually use it, actually, because it's quite fun. You know, as an actor, you travel quite a lot. I got you a travel Cluedo. There's method in my madness. Knives out.
Oh, yes, knives out, yes.
I mean, could they add any more actors to this list of people that are going to be involved in the next Knives Out film? It's so exciting.
Well, they can, and they're going to.
Oh.
Mm.
Yeah. Fellow Irishman just announced.
Yes, Daryl yes. McCormick. Yeah.
I mean, it's, I mean, I love these films. They're just, you know, talk about kind of giving actors license to play and have fun.
Yeah.
And the way that Daniel has run with his character is so great.
Yeah.
And kind of so refreshing, I think, as well. And then bring in these kind of, you know, this mix of characters. It's just, it's so new.
Yeah.
Even though it's a, such an old and tested genre.
Yeah, like it's these, they're these kind of whodunit films, and actually even the announcing of the cast is kind of, it's become a thing.
It's going,
like,
crazy it, about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, people are speculating, I like this, and blah, blah, blah. That's pretty old school as well. Again, that's another thing that I think, oh, wow, I'd love to be in one of those kind of things.
And you are!
And I am.
And you can't talk about it.
Yeah, not really, yeah. But yeah, he's very, very clever, and you know, it's very actor-led, and we kind of, quite a lot of group scenes, which is always fun, because for some reason, with Ripley, and I did a one-man play last year, there's been a kind of shortage of actors. So I love actors, so it's always fun to be sort of in group scenes, because, you know.
Yeah.
You know, when we did Pride, you know, that was so fun, because there was just always, it was about lots of groups of people. And so it was just brilliant. It was just so incredibly, incredibly fun.
What informs your decisions? I don't know, are you looking for something? You know, you're talking about you want to work with kind of ensembles and lots of actors. Is it that kind of thought out? Or
no, I wouldn't say it's that thought out, but I would say that there's a couple of things. Number one is that you go, you want to do something slightly different than you've just sort of done. So you think, oh God, I don't want to be. So I've done quite a lot of sad things quite recently. So I'd like to do something now, like, you know, Knives Out is not sad.
Unless you die.
For some people that might be sad.
True.
Sorry, he says diplomatically. And so you want to do that. But I always think you have to, I think to have no jokes in anything is bad manners. I really genuinely do. If a script is really, really serious, I don't find it attractive, because I don't think that's the way human beings are. Or certainly the ones that I'm interested in. I think the best thing about human beings is that even at our worst time, we always look to the light. And I think that's our job, is to reflect what it's like to be a human being. And I think finding light is always very moving. So I like gags. Yeah, got jokes and scripts. So that's what I would say I would look for.
When you talk about as well, like being a real wordsmith and being words are the thing for you, are you writing, you know, in terms of, have you got kind of aspirations to kind of be on that other side of it in terms of creating?
Yeah, I do. And More and More Vanya was something that we created together. And it is. I have enormous respect for writers, and a lot of the people that I love in my life are, you know, real geniuses at writing. So I'm intimidated by it. I'm not intimidated when I'm not the chief writer. I'm like, no, we don't need to say that. Or maybe that. And so I have a real respect for it, and I love to be involved. Whether I would, I don't know, I think perhaps I need a very strong story.
Musical, perhaps?
Perhaps. I mean, God, Jesus, no. Jesus, no, no. That's not.
You and Aisling B should write a musical together.
Oh, God. She's so clever. She would be able to do that. I would be able to be on the side, you know. Tapping along. Yeah.
I'd watch that.
Have you watched that?
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you're easily pleased, Edith. Yeah. Come on.
Well, no, I'm not at all. I'm not. Well, I am. I guess I am. What is next? What are we seeing you in next?
What's coming
out? The Cameron Diaz and Jamie Foxx.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
Back to the Foxes.
Back to Foxes. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wonder if he likes Dido.
Jamie Foxx.
Yeah.
What would you say? Let's put a show of hands. but yeah, back in action. That's coming out soon. So Cameron Diaz has been out of action.
Yeah.
And now
did
she's
they choose
back in
that
action.
Title especially?
Yeah. I think they probably did. Yeah, that's coming out later in the year. I've only got a little bit in that.
It's an action film. I like it.
Yeah, it's an action. It's another thing. I hadn't really done very much action. And I always say about Ripley, that boat scene, I mean, I'm still getting over it. I mean, there was no, all that was, you know, the thing where you have to bury the boat. They just kept the cameras running until I buried that boat. That wasn't like, he was like, well, you know, you just keep going until the boat sinks. And you can, I think it's quite a pleasing shot where you see all the water filling in and you see it sinking.
Yeah.
So you just had to be in there in the middle of the.
Wow.
Keep going, Andrew.
Shouting from the,
I thought you were talking to someone else. I was like,
no, I was just like, that. That's what he's shouting while this is still filming. Okay. Camera's still rolling. Yeah. Keep fishing.
Keep going. Yeah, literally. And you know, picking up the rocks and falling in and trying to get into a boat from the sea when you've done 40 awful takes of something. You know, it is genuinely exhausting. So it felt like an action thing to me.
Yeah. We've probably got time for 5 minutes to do a couple of audience questions if anybody has any questions. Right in the middle there was straight up with the first hand, so I'm going to go, sorry, Amy, right in the middle. And then actually, once you've done, if you could pass your mic forward to the young lady there. Yeah, go. Hi.
Hi. Congratulations on Ripley. Are you guilty of producing something that is too good for TV, given our response to it in the cinema?
That's not a question for me to answer, am I? Well, I don't know. It does feel like it's quite cinematic. I don't know. Maybe just people should just... People have big TVs, though, don't they?
Good answer.
Yeah, I think I like the fact that it's got very high standards visually. And I think maybe some more TV could learn a bit from that because, you know, there's no reason, because we're in the golden age of television, why it can't look sensational. Mm. So I hope I'm guilty.
Hello.
Hello, Andrew. I'm Sasha. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
My question is, so obviously you've had quite a long career. I know you had your, correct me if I'm wrong, because you probably know better than I do, but you had your professional debut in a film at 17, and then you went to uni to study drama, and then you dropped out, and you went to a theatre in Ireland,
then
you moved to London.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask, or if you could tell us a bit about the journey of your career and what that's been like, because currently I'm trying to get my foot in the door and it doesn't seem like there's a right way to do it, and it can be quite frustrating. So that's my first question. And secondly, how do you keep the momentum of keeping on trying to pursue your dream where it's you can apply for things hundreds of times and it's if you don't get anything back,
constant.
Not
the first thing I would say to you about so-called, you know, successful actors is that everything, you know, history is told backwards. So that you go, okay, well, that looks great. So you did that, dropped out a thing, and then you joined the Abbey Theatre, and then you moved to London and you got a job, and then that's what they write about retrospectively. And of course, what happens after you drop out of university is you think, fuck, I don't know, I have no idea what's going to happen. And then something happens because that's the way life is. So sometimes I think the way successful actors' careers or paths are reported, there's a kind of falsity to it a little, you know, so that just to understand that every single actor working, no matter how successful they are, have had at some point a bit where they go, I have absolutely no prospects. I have no idea what's going to happen. And I'd say one of the things that you have to learn and embrace in some ways is that feeling, is that, and you, with experience, you go, well, I have been here before. And it still happens. It really does happen, because even when you're at a certain stage, it becomes about not just employment, but about how do you keep a standard high, rather than just what happens at the very beginning is you kind of, you're just trying to get as much experience as possible. So I would just say is to try and get used to the fact that you don't know what's going to happen next, and something will always emerge, and to listen to your own voice as much. And that's, I think it's quite a good life lesson. I remember during the pandemic when everybody who have very, very regimented lives where everything is planned out and they have a pension and they're working. And a lot of people that I know who have those lives were really, really struggled. And a lot of the actors I know were like, well, it's just a Tuesday morning at 11 o'clock. You have to try and cultivate your own day.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to be self-motoring. And that can be quite difficult depending on how your spirit is, you know. And if you get, you know, knocks, that's hard. It's hard to, that's really difficult. But what I would say is the reason that people are cast is for so many different reasons, it's not necessarily always to do with your talent. They're looking at a whole, so when they're casting Knives Out, they have to look at so many different types of things and requirements and how that person might look alongside that person. There's lots of different things that aren't necessarily to do with you. I think it's awful. Actors don't sometimes get feedback when they go for auditions. I think it's really outrageous, actually, because when most people apply for a job, they can find out at least that they weren't successful. And I think it's really awful. What they do now is they ask actors to learn 11 pages of dialogue. You know, they have to take time off work, whatever work they're doing to survive. And you have to learn, sometimes you do this 3 or 4 times a week, 11 pages of dialogue. You self-tape. You don't get any direction as to what the person might be wanting. And that's sometimes actors need to go, oh, you want that person to be darker. Okay, well, I can do that. But if you don't know, you're just literally spending so much time and effort, and you put it out and you don't even hear whether you got that. You read it in the paper. I just think that has to change in our industry. I really, really, really do. And I understand that people don't sometimes always have an immediate answer. But I think that's very debilitating. For that reason, you know, it can be hard. So it is tough. It is tough, but it's also a completely wonderful, I think, very honourable thing to do with your life.
We wish you all the best, and we hope to see you up here at some point as well, doing the same thing. Yeah,
you can come on my musical. I don't know if you can do that, but I can teach you.
Listen, we run out of time. But it's so great to have all of you guys here tonight. Thank you for giving up your Friday night.
Yes, thank you so much.
And thank you so much for being here.
Oh, you're so welcome. My pleasure.
It's so great.
Thanks for watching.
And excited for Knives Out and the musical as well.
Thank you. And thank you for this beautiful day. Thank you.
Thanks very much, everybody. Andrew Scott, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you. That was so lovely. Thank you.
From the score to Ripley, that Sicily variation, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the fabulous Andrew Scott. My huge thanks to Andrew, to also to his team, to the wonderful gang at Everyman, and to all of you who came along to support this particular film club. We have got quite a few. We're taking a little break over the next couple of months just because it's a busy time with summer with everybody. But we'll be back hopefully August time, and I'll make sure that I let you know ahead of that who that's going to be. And then we've got loads planned between now and the end of the year. Ripley, if you haven't already watched it, is available to watch on Netflix right now, and I highly recommend that you do. Now, as well as being able to find us, the podcast, wherever you get your pods, we have a great search feature at edithbowman.com. So do have a look at that if you haven't already. There's about 450 episodes for you to dive into. And if you aren't already, please find us at Soundtrackin' UK on your socials. And we also have a YouTube channel called Soundtrackin' Extra that we would love for you to subscribe to, because as well as putting lovely versions of the podcast up there, we also have fantastic little extra bits and bobs as well that we do. Next up, we have another deep dive into the beautiful relationship of film and music. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.